Good morning. It's time for the Doctor's Point of View. This is Debbie Buskey. Joining me again this morning is Dr. Matthew Minahan, oncologist. Good morning, Dr. Minahan.
Good morning, Debbie. How are you doing today?
Oh, well, I'm trying to stay cool, you know, I guess.
Easier said than done.
Correct. But, you know, once you just set your mind and, like, look, it's July, it's going to be hot, you know
right.
it. I mean, you just do the common sense thing. Stay inside. Drink
you got it.
Water, right? Go to the spa, you know, just stay inside. Anyway, but we're very fortunate that we're able to do that. You know, we certainly are looking forward to having our conversation this morning just to help some of the folks who aren't quite as, healthy or aren't quite
right.
as fortunate as we are. But wanted to talk about cancers, of course, once again. But one lady asked me, and she says, why is it women lose their hair more than men when they're taking chemo?
Well, that's a great question. Hair loss really has to do with what type of chemotherapy we are using. Not every chemotherapy makes you lose your hair.
Oh, really?
Right. And the idea is that most of our chemotherapies are work best against cells that are multiplying rapidly. I mean, that's what cancer is, right? It's cells that are multiplying more than they should, making more of themselves. And you have cells in your body that naturally do this normally in a healthy situation, and that includes your hair cells and the lining of your gut, which is why two common side effects of some chemotherapies is hair loss and nausea or vomiting, because you get effects on those cells that are rapidly dividing in a normal healthy state. So as to why people might think that women tend to lose hair more than men, I think it just has to do with what kind of cancers you're probably more likely to see in the community. So the four most common cancers overall are going to be breast, lung, colon, and prostate cancers. And only two of those four are kind of commonly shared by men and women, right? The colon cancer and the lung cancer. And for those two cancers, you don't typically lose your hair with most of the regimens that we would use. And then prostate cancer, we don't even use chemotherapy up front. It takes a while for us to get there, and so usually people don't lose their hair with that. So the four most common cancers, breast cancer is the only one where we typically see hair loss because of the treatments that we're using, and 99% of the patients with breast cancer are women. So I think it just has to do with how common different cancers are and which drugs we use. But for instance, in leukemia, it's more or less even presentation of men and women. And for the acute leukemias, we give medications that make people lose their hair, and men lose it just as easily as women.
But I guess because we see women who have lost their hair, it's more visual to realize
right.
and that they have breast cancer versus some of the other kinds of cancer.
Okay. That's exactly okay. right.
I guess that's why it's such a drastic thing. Now, is there something we can do to kind of not necessarily keep that from happening but help it grow faster, or you just wait till you're finished with all the chemo?
Well, that's a really interesting question, actually, because in the last year or two, there's an FDA-approved device. The name of it is escaping me right now because I haven't seen it used yet. But basically what it is it's a cap system that you would bring to the infusion center when you're getting your chemotherapy, and you place it on your head, and it cools your scalp while you're getting chemotherapy. And the idea behind it is that it would constrict the blood vessels in your scalp, which would reduce the amount of blood flow to the scalp, which means your scalp is getting less of a chemotherapy dose, which means you don't lose as much hair. And so the downside, in purely theoretical, is that, you know, you could then potentially, if you're getting a lower dose of chemotherapy to your scalp, could you have a recurrence or cancer present in your scalp? That's pretty rare. We haven't been doing this long enough to really know if that's a problem, but there are people who are using this system to try to prevent hair loss during chemotherapy, and you do see some women using it. Other than that, it's really just about time. It usually takes 4 to 6 weeks for hair to grow back, and sometimes it grows back different colors. It may grow back curly when it used to be straight, but pretty much it will grow back in 4 to 6 weeks after treatment is complete.
Well, how did you know that's what I was going to ask you? Because some people, they, you know, didn't have a whole lot of hair, and now they've got this thick, voluptuous hair.
Right.
Like you said, and sometimes it comes back curly, and so there's no rhyme or reason to that?
Not that I know of. Maybe somebody smarter than me has looked into it.
It's okay. All right, so now we got into those. I know you said that there's... And there's another one I was going to ask you about. We talked about the four most common, which was breast, lung, colon, and prostate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that I've been hearing people talking about having to go get a shot called Procrit or something mm-hmm. of that nature. Now, is that because of the breast, lung, colon, or is that a different type of cancer that you need Procrit for?
Right. So Procrit is in a class of drugs called, it's a mouthful, erythropoietin-stimulating agents. Erythropoietin, or EPO for short, EPO, is a synthetic version of a natural hormone that your kidney produces. And so the idea is that your kidney is the organ that senses if you have enough red blood cells, which are the oxygen carriers, or if you need more. And it sends a signal to your bone marrow to tell it how many red blood cells to make sure you've got the right amount. And in certain disorders, for instance, chronic kidney disease, if it gets bad enough, the kidney just doesn't make enough of the hormone, and the healthy bone marrow is just sitting there not getting the signal. And in some cancer states, maybe it's a mix of both. Somebody's got kidney disease, or the bone marrow just isn't working quite at top notch and needs a little bit extra boost. And so we'll give people this shot, and there's other versions of it too, but basically what it does is it gives this hormone in a higher amount and kind of stimulates the bone marrow to make more red blood cells. And the idea behind it is that you would be avoiding transfusions as much as possible, getting blood transfusions.
Okay, so the Procrit you're talking is about related to bone marrow. So does that mean you probably have leukemia?
So we'll use it in certain versions of, some people call it pre-leukemia or myelodysplastic syndrome.
Okay.
And also in solid tumors, so sometimes just the chemotherapy we give affects the bone marrow, and then that means that the bone marrow has a hard time making red blood cells because of the drugs we're giving. And we could just give those people transfusions, but sometimes we'll give the shot instead in order to avoid having to give transfusions. So you could have low blood counts from the cancer itself, especially leukemias, lymphomas, and myelodysplastic syndrome. You could also have direct bone marrow involvement of solid tumors, like prostate cancer likes to go to the bone when it spreads. And so if enough prostate cancer is in your bones, your bone marrow doesn't work. Or it could just be the drugs that we're giving you make your bone marrow not work as well. And this shot is one of the things we have in our toolbox to try to avoid transfusions.
Okay, so do you have to have blood work done before you get this shot? Is there like certain levels of this shot?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Okay.
This is actually a very highly regulated medication. We actually have to go, any prescriber that's going to give it has to go through a specialized training course. And the reason is because when they originally did the studies determining how best to dose this, they were a little bit too aggressive with the goal. So red blood cell count, one of the ways we measure it is something called hemoglobin. And a normal hemoglobin for a man is around 13 to 16, and for women is around 12 to 15, depending on the lab that's measuring it. And they originally were targeting getting close to normal values, and so they were giving a lot of this medication. And what we found is that people had decreased need of transfusions, but they actually had some bad outcomes, including blood clots like strokes. And there was also some concern that in cancer patients, it might make the cancer progress sooner. And that data is still a little murky. But now what we do is we don't target a normal value. We target a hemoglobin of 10, which is quite low compared to normal values. And with that lower targeted range, we feel like the risk and benefit is more acceptable. You know, the alternative is not to do the shots and just to get blood transfusions, but blood transfusions have their own set of risks and benefits. So, you know, it's one of those things where you got to tailor it to each patient. You have to talk to each patient about the risks and benefits. And before you can receive this shot, you do have to have blood work proving that your hemoglobin's less than 10. So we won't give it to you unless the hemoglobin's less than 10. And you also need to make sure that your B12, folate, and iron stores are completely repleted because the bone marrow needs the building blocks to make red blood cells. And if you give this shot without those building blocks in place, then you could run into problems.
Okay, so now the question being, if you have the cancer, say you have a particular type of cancer and you've been living with it for a couple of years, do you get this once a month, every week, or how often, or how long can you get ProCrit shots?
Oh, so we only give them for solid tumor patients, meaning, you know, like we talked about, breast, lung, colon, prostate, that kind of thing. We don't give it to people who are curable. We only give it to people who are on chemotherapy, you know, for good, pretty much.
Okay.
And if you have myelodysplastic syndrome, which is kind of like pre-leukemia, then we can give it indefinitely. As far as the frequency goes, it depends on which drug you're using. There's ProCrit, there's one called Aranesp, there's a bunch of different ones. And I usually start with a once every 3 weeks, and you can kind of titrate it from there. If someone needs it more frequently, you can do it more frequently. You can do bigger doses spread apart. You can do smaller doses more frequently. Sometimes in kidney cancer patients, if they're getting dialysis 3 times a week, they might just get the shot every time they get dialysis and just get a lower dose. So there's a lot of flexibility.
Oh, wow. I guess I didn't realize that. I thought it was like a once-a-month shot, but it could be. And then it would just depend upon, like you said, it's those. Now, there are people who are on what you call not necessarily chronic leukemia, chemotherapy, but it's long-term for whatever it is they have that they just have to live with till the end.
Right. So it really depends on the kind of cancer. For instance, for lung cancer, there's some variability in practice, but my typical practice for lung cancer that's spread and is incurable, we would do around 4 months of chemotherapy, and then we would stop, and we wouldn't talk about doing any more treatment until it came back or progressed, depending on the kind of lung cancer. Whereas with colon cancer, typically you start chemotherapy and you keep doing it either until it stops working or till the side effects become too much of a burden. But you could be on chemotherapy for over a year without a break. And so, you know, it really depends on the tumor.
Okay, and then we talked earlier about the, you know, the type of chemo that you're getting can, I guess what you say, affect your gut, because that's when people get nauseated from that. Now, what can you do for that?
Well, we have a lot of really good anti-nausea medications nowadays. And so, depending on the chemotherapy, we actually kind of have split, you know, through experience, we have kind of 4 categories of chemotherapy nausea risk. So high risk, intermediate, low, and minimal. And we tailor the anti-nausea drugs to match how bad the nausea is going to be. So for, you know, a really highly risky drug, something that we know is going to cause a lot of nausea, we usually give, when the day that you get the drugs, we give you 3 medications while you're in the chair getting the drugs. So 2 of them, all 3 of them are IV. And then we'd send you home and give you medications to take scheduled at home, and then we also give you medications as a backup. And there's probably, 4 or 5 different classes of anti-nausea medications. You can mix and match, and that's kind of one of the more the art of this, is trying to figure out, because everybody's a little bit different, what kind of regimen they're going to need. But we get really aggressive with giving anti-nausea medications. The other thing that's nice about an oncology clinic like we have here in Bastrop with Texas Oncology and out in Austin, too, is that we can bring you in for fluids, which is more than most clinics can do. So if you get nauseated and you're not eating and you get dehydrated, that can actually make you more nauseated. So we can bring you in, we can give you more IV medications, we can give you IV fluids with the goal of preventing you from having too much nausea and preventing you from being admitted to the hospital. What I usually tell people is I can't promise that you'll never throw up once through the whole course, but you shouldn't be at home throwing up. You know, you might get a little queasy on a couple of days, but my goal is that you're not, you know, vomiting is not the main symptom you're dealing with.
Wonderful, because I think that, you know, years ago that was the biggest side effect that everyone complained about, other than being fatigued and, you know, and things of that nature. So is there anything for the fatigue?
Fatigue is probably the trickiest thing that we deal with. And it's hard because it's so complicated and there's so many different reasons you could be fatigued. You can be fatigued from the cancer itself. You can be fatigued from the treatments. You can be fatigued because you're nauseated and haven't been eating great. You can be fatigued because you're dehydrated. You could be fatigued because it's Texas and it's 100 degrees outside. You know, there's any number of reasons. You're on multiple new medications and side effects can build up. Maybe you're not sleeping at night. Maybe you've got other medical problems in the background that have always, that have just been complicated now. So we do everything we can. We try to be really cognizant of why somebody's fatigued and try to chip away at it. Part of it, too, is that balance of, you know, if all you do is lay around all day, you're going to be fatigued. But at the same time, you're undergoing aggressive treatment. You can't be out running around like you normally do. And so it's a balance of making sure you get some level of activity, right, without overdoing it. It's about managing your medications. It's about having realistic expectations for what you can accomplish in a day. You know, you're not going to be able to do 8 hours in a row of errands on a day where you're getting chemotherapy. You know, you're going to have to tailor your schedule. And so the unfortunate reality is that some people are going to have fatigue. The good news is it usually gets better as we kind of get further out from treatment and can manage some of these side effects.
And that just goes by going through it. So the first couple of rounds of chemo, you may experience some problems, but after going, then you kind of start to realize, okay, I can do this, or it's going to take this long, and kind of schedule your day.
Right. And, you know, like I said, it's different for everybody. There are some people who, for instance, lymphoma patients, they might come in with a lot of fatigue, and the first couple of rounds of chemo, they actually feel amazingly better because the cancer is, you know, responding, and then they're getting their energy back. And then, you know, by cycle 4, 5, 6 of chemo, maybe they're starting to get fatigued again, but now it's because the chemotherapy is starting to take a little bit of a toll. So, you know, it's a moving target. You know, every visit you have to reevaluate why the fatigue might be happening and try to address it. So...
Wow. And here I had it, we were going to talk about surviving, which is another topic we need to do, but we've run out of time. But certainly,
we'll table it for another time.
Yes, we certainly want to get into the survivorship, but I just basically wanted to make sure that I was on the same page. Of course, you know, folks want to know, I think that's some wonderful information about that cap that you can use to prevent some of the hair loss, and, mm-hmm. you know, about the Procrit shot, and it just, you know, the transfusions and the many different signals. I know the biggest thing is, no one wants to hear that word cancer, but it's kind of wonderful to know that we have people like yourself and Texas Oncology out there to try to help us through whatever horrible thing we may have been diagnosed with.
Right. Nobody wants to deal with it, but it, you know, unfortunately, it's one of those realities of life, and we're glad to be here and help people walk through it.
And you offer so much right there in the Bastrop Clinic that, you know, we don't have to travel to Austin or Katy or Houston or, you know, San Antonio for most of these things.
That's right. So here in Bastrop at Texas Oncology, we have the ability to give chemotherapies. We can do the Procrit shots, any number of other shots. We can do IV fluids. The only thing we don't have here is blood transfusions, but, you know, we can arrange for those pretty easily for our patients, and it does save the long trek into the big city, which is kind of nice.
Now, are you able to do the biopsies there as well?
Yeah, so I do bone marrow biopsies here in this clinic. You can also do it with a radiologist. That would have to be arranged in a hospital, but, you know, I kind of tailor it to the patient preference and do whatever they like.
Awesome. All right. Can you give us the office phone number for Bastrop?
Yeah. So our office here in Bastrop is going to be 512-308-9024. We're open Monday through Friday from 8:30 to 5.
All right. And there's several different types of oncology doctors there in that clinic.
So right now we have three medical oncologists, including myself. We, as of September 1st, we're planning to get a breast surgeon, and we also, around that same time, we'll be getting a medical oncology nurse practitioner to help us out with some things as well. So that's for the short term. We have some bigger long-term plans, but I'll hold off on those till they're more firm.
All right, till our next session at least, right?
Right.
Okay. All right. Dr. Matthew Minahan, thank you so much for joining me here this morning, and thanks to Texas Oncology for allowing you to give this wonderful information to our listeners here.
My pleasure, anytime.
And stay cool.
You too.
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to thank my sponsors this morning for allowing the Doctor's Point of View on your hometown radio, 98.3.